Great. Well, thank you, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here. This has been many years in the making since the organizers invited me to come and speak. And in this intervening time, my own research interests have shifted and changed in interesting ways. Not only am I a faculty member at MIT, but I'm the director of a new National Science Foundation-funded institute, the Institute for Artificial Intelligence and Fundamental Interactions. And so if any of you are actually interested in combining together computation and physics, we have a postdoctoral fellowship program whose deadline is October 11th for anyone who's interested in that opportunity. I was telling people that I was coming to the Perimeter Institute to talk about the Standard Model and that I was given 2 hours. And my friend said, wow, the Standard Model deserves more than 2 hours. It is an incredible achievement of both experimentation and theory, and I can only touch very lightly on the features of the Standard Model. And I decided to take a little bit of a risk, so I've only prepared one of these 2 hours, so I only have one lecture's worth of material, because I want to know what you're interested in finding out about. So today I'm going to try to talk about the structure of the Standard Model. But then on Wednesday, for my second hour, it's the questions that you might have. Are you interested in the Higgs mechanism, electric dipole moments, anomalous magnetic moments, neutrino mass generation, proton decay, anything else you want? These are things that are features or non-features of the Standard Model that I'm happy to tell you about. And so I really mean it. And so during the discussion, you know, let me know. I'll probably write the lecture for Wednesday on Tuesday night, trying to incorporate your feedback. And my goal is to highlight features of the Standard Model that are elegant and inevitable, as well as the things that are ugly and confusing. And hopefully you'll get a sense of that in these lectures today. So I want to start off just by talking about some of the principles and paradigms that we have that describe the Standard Model. The distinction between a principle and a paradigm is not so clear, so I've made kind of an artificial division. Sometimes principles are things that we could imagine being true in every possible universe, and paradigms are the things that happen to be true in our universe. So, for example, to the best of our knowledge, our universe is quantum mechanical. And among various features, that means that if you calculate some process in quantum mechanics, probabilities have to add up to 100%. So we have unitarity. And to the best of our knowledge, our universe, and probably any reasonable universe, satisfies quantum mechanical unitarity. To the best of our knowledge, our universe, to an excellent approximation, at least locally, we're not going to be talking about the universe as a whole, but, you know, for example, for describing the things in this universe, it seems like things are Lorentz invariant. And what does that mean in terms of the structure of the Standard Model? It means that when you talk about the ingredients of the Standard Model, you can characterize them by their properties under the Lorentz group, or more generally, the Poincaré group. So for example, we know that things are going to be characterized by their mass and characterized by their spin. We seem to have evidence that as a symmetry, the combination of charge, parity, and time reversal is correct, and we think that that, when combined with like ideas of spin statistics, mean that spin and its quantum mechanical nature under bosons and fermions seems to be related. So, for example, we know that integer spin particles apparently always have to be bosons, and half integer spins apparently always have to be fermions. And we think that the laws of universe are local and causal. So we have locality and causality, which has implications for the types of interactions that we can have. So when you see some interaction between bodies that are far extended, we think there's actually a force carrier that mediates that interaction, and those interactions have a contact form fundamentally. And so this, for example, leads to the fact that forces have a relationship to fields or propagators. Okay. And, you know, there's a longer list of principles. These are going to be the ones that are going to be relevant for this lecture today. There's also things that we don't know if they're true. For example, we don't know whether or not nature allows for exact global symmetries. in the context of the standard model, there are approximate symmetries, for example, baryon number, lepton number, that appear to be conserved. And every time you have a global symmetry, there's a conservation law. But we actually don't know in the context of a full theory of quantum gravity whether it's possible to have global symmetries and whether these things that keep, for example, the proton stable, baryon number conservation, whether that actually is fundamentally violated by in quantum gravity. There's things that I work on, things like supersymmetry, which is a symmetry that extends space-time, basically relates bosons and fermions, relates integer and half-integer spins together. We don't know if that's realized in nature. That would be incredible to see an extension of our notion of space and time to have kind of a quantum dimension. We don't know if that's realized. And then one that causes me heartache and headache and was part of the reason why I decided that I wanted to shift into thinking more about computation and artificial intelligence, because I thought maybe a machine could help me solve problems like this. The thorny issue of naturalness. Naturalness is a question about if you're trying to write down a quantum field theory, should you have radiative corrections that are controlled in some way? And that would actually imply the existence of physics beyond the standard model that we have not seen. And, you know, is it true that every universe satisfies this principle of naturalness? So these are some of the principles that we're going to be using for building the standard model. There's also paradigms, like specifically in the standard model, things that are realized. And these are things which I'm happy to tell you more about. A lot of these are related to my own research program. So within the context of the standard model, we see spontaneous symmetry breaking. In particular, the Higgs mechanism appears to be the way that masses in the standard model are generated. So we'll discuss more of that later today. Within the standard model, there are dynamics, the confining dynamics of the strong force, whose twin is asymptotic freedom, where when you go to very short distances, apparently the interactions of the strong force become weaker and therefore calculable within the perturbative tools of quantum field theory. We have accidental symmetries, things that are important for our existence. So accidental symmetries, in particular, in the standard model, we have baryon and lepton number, which are approximately conserved, at least to the best of our knowledge, they haven't been violated, which would lead, for example, to proton stability. And then, you know, there's other paradigms that we could talk about. And then there's the question marks of the paradigms that we think, which we need in order to explain dynamics beyond the standard model. So, for example, within the standard model itself, the standard model, okay, this is debatable, and I can explain more why I'm hedging on this, but what you will hear people say is you will see that the standard model does not accommodate neutrino masses. There's an asterisk on that statement. But for neutrino masses, there's a very fundamental question about the nature of the neutrino mass that we observe in nature, whether it's Majorana versus Dirac. We don't know the precise mechanism for neutrino mass generation, and it's a paradigm that we need experimental evidence for, some of which is quasi-tabletop in form. There seems to be more stuff than ordinary stuff. So, for example, we have overwhelming gravitational evidence for this stuff called dark matter. We don't know what that dark matter is, and you're going to have many other lectures about this. And I'm realizing that this podium may be getting in the way of you folks over there, so let me see if I can... You know what? Let me not try to move this thing. I'm going to break this, so I apologize. I'll try. What? Oh, everybody can see it up there. Fantastic. Oh, excellent. I had no idea. And so if I scoop down here, or if I, like, lie on the ground here, you can still see me. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah, I got it. But by the way, I'm sweating both because it's hot in this room, but also I'm really excited about the standard model. So if you see me, like, dripping, okay, through these lectures, it's because the standard model is awesome. Okay. We have baryogenesis. Why is there more matter than antimatter? And that could have implications, or that will have implications for things you might see. And then unification of couplings, and, you know, inflation, you know, what drives the early accelerated expansion of the universe, and so on and so forth. And these are things that are not within the standard model. But we think that whatever this stuff is, most likely it's going to satisfy these principles here. Or maybe not. Maybe there's going to be a violation of those principles. But when you're, you know, searching for new phenomena beyond the standard model, you should know what you're breaking, right? So if you say, I'm going to look for violations of the structure of general relativity, looking for example, fifth forces or modifications of gravity, know, and you'll see this in the lecture, know that you're violating some of these really core things. And maybe you're bold, and maybe you want to do that, or maybe you think that nature works that way. But just understand that the stuff in the universe is not random. Okay, some of the things seem random, and we'll get to the parts of the universe that seem random. But other things are really baked into the structure of what we see. And so when you find deviations, it's not just, oh, I found a little deviation. It would overturn the underpinnings of what we think, you know, even a physical theory is supposed to be. Okay? So the stakes are high if you find deviations from the standard model. And principles have consequences. And that's the thing that I want to emphasize here. Even if you don't understand the details of what I say, understand that principles have consequences. And experimental measurements can change our idea of what principles are realized in nature. Okay, so let me pause here to see if there's any comments or questions before I continue. And I guess there are there are cubes that can be passed around. And so while you're doing that, I'm going to start erasing the board. But please, if you have anything that you want to ask about, or if you say, ooh, I really want to learn about something else for next time, now is the time that we can start to build lecture two in terms of your interests. But I'm going to start erasing the board, and Mina will toss that cube around. Early morning. I flew in really late last night. A friend of mine from high school got married. I was in DC at the Waldorf Astoria, very fancy. And then I came here after a wedding. So, you know, if my brain is not fully functioning, you can blame my high school friends and the partying that we had in DC. Okay. Okay, so the thing that I want to emphasize, as I said, is that principles have consequences. And so I'm not actually going to explain exactly the logic that leads to this, so some of this you're just going to have to believe me. Also, a lot of this stuff has asterisks on it, so I'm going to say something that may be only somewhat true, and a lot of these things are cases where there's subtleties about the extent to which they're true or not. Happy to talk to you about that, but hopefully this will give you a gist of the way that principles meet the consequences in terms of the structure of the standard model. So one thing that appears to be true is that the forces in the standard model are weakly coupled. And what that means is that we have, to a very good approximation, a particle description of nature. If the universe were strongly coupled, then you couldn't talk about individual particles. Basically, their interactions would be so strong that you couldn't really isolate one particle for another. But we can talk meaningfully about the electron. Yes, the electron has a cloud of photons surrounding it, and really, formally, you can't really disentangle those things, but it makes sense to talk about the electron and the photon separately. It makes sense, for example, to talk about quarks individually once you get into the weak field regime of quantum chromodynamics. So things have a particle description. And because of Lorentz symmetry, and I really should say Lorentz and Poincaré symmetry, particles have a well-defined mass. And again, there's asterisks on that word well-defined. Let me sweep that under the rug. Okay. And so because of that, if you would say, hey, I have a particle, I want to understand what its properties are, you now have Well, you have to say, okay, what is the mass of that particle? And depending on that mass of the particle, there's different consequences that follow from the principles of quantum mechanics. So, for example, let's start off with massive particles. So someone gives you a particle, that particle is running around, it has some energy, it has some momentum, it's moving in some direction. That's supposed to be a particle. But if it's massive, then you can do a Lorentz boost to go to its rest frame. So you can do a Lorentz boost, you can have that particle now sitting at rest. And if you look at the properties of that particle, it's just a dot. And if you do rotations in 3D around that dot, basically, so rotations in three dimensions, which is known as SO3, which is similar to SU2, if people know that relationship. And that means that if you want to specify the properties of that particle, that dot, you have to specify, one, what its mass is, but then also how it transforms under rotations in 3D. And that gives rise to spin. So if you have a massive particle, you have to specify what its spin is. And again, the reason why you can do this is because we think that Lorentz symmetry is a good symmetry. You can boost to its rest frame for a massive particle, and that tells you what the spin of that particle is. Now, spin is the way things transform under rotations. This is something that you learn about in, you know, an elementary quantum mechanics class, and you learned that spins can be zero, or a half, or one, or three halves, or two, or five halves, so on and so forth. And the integer ones are bosons, the half integer ones are fermions, that's what you learned. And a principle that I'm not going to tell you about exactly where it comes from, but if you ask, can we have an arbitrarily a short distance description of massive particles? The answer is that if the spin is greater than one, if the spin is greater than one and it's massive, then that state can't be fundamental. That doesn't mean that you can't have high spin massive particles. We have all sorts of high spin massive particles around. One of them is the W and Z boson. That's a massive spin one particles. But they can't be fundamental. That is, their description, because of quantum mechanical unitarity, breaks down at some point. And so, for example, for spin one in the standard model, for spin one, we have these massive W and Z bosons, W plus minus and Z bosons. And what we learned is that they can't be fundamental. Maybe there's some composite states of some more complicated strong dynamics. Or in the case of the standard model, we think that their masses come from the so-called Higgs mechanism, which we'll discuss, potentially discuss more in lecture two. Okay. They can't be fundamental. And just because I love supersymmetry, if you have a spin three halves massive particle, this actually implies, or not implies, one way of getting a spin three halves particle in the context of supergravity is the so-called super Higgs mechanism. But if someone says, hey, I have a fundamental massive spin two particle, for example, maybe think that the graviton, which is a spin two particle, maybe that has mass. The principles of quantum mechanics say, well, actually, it can't be fundamental. Or if it is fundamental, there's the like giant asterisk on this. For example, you could have like a whole tower of spins, infinite number of spins. But you know, in the typical telling of the story, these ones can't be fundamental. And now you can just ask, okay, within the context of the standard model, if we think that the standard model is a quasi-fundamental description of nature, it doesn't have any of these. It does not apparently have any of these. And in the context of the standard model, we have four of these, which are form the so-called Higgs multiplet. Okay. So again, the principle, the principle that has consequences, quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, tells you that when you have a certain spin, whether it's fundamental or not, and that drives our understanding of the structure of the standard model. And so you can't just willy-nilly throw ingredients in. Quantum mechanical unitarity tells you a constraint on high spin massive particles. Again, they can exist, but they have to be composite in some way or come from another type of mechanism. Now, things start to get really interesting when we start talking about massless particles. And the reason why massless particles start to become really interesting is that they don't have a rest frame. So to the best of our knowledge, light travels at the speed of light. It's a massless particle. And you can't run and catch up with light. You can't, you know, run really fast and try to catch up and even watch light go the other direction. That can't happen. You can't move to the rest frame of a photon. And so if you have a photon, I'm just drawing it with a wiggly line. That's supposed to kind of like make you think of electromagnetic radiation, you know, E and B fields. If you have a wiggly line and you do a boost, and you say, I would like to get to the rest frame of the photon. Sorry, you cannot do that. It's still going to be a wiggly line, still traveling at the speed of light, still not having mass. And if I think about the symmetries that this has, unlike the case of this particle at rest, where I can, you know, do a rotation this way, or a rotation this way, or a rotation this way, those are supposed to be the x, y, and z axis rotations. If I have a particle like this, the only kind of, well, not the only, but roughly speaking, the only symmetry that I can do is kind of rotate that particle around its axis of motion. And that means if I have a massless particle and I'm going to characterize its properties, I have to characterize it, again, with asterisks under SO2, that's the rotations in 2D, okay, which is basically like U1. People know what that means. And that means that when I have massless particles, they're characterized by their helicity, with an asterisk here because, okay, there's actually some subtleties, something that's called continuous spin representations, which I can tell you about if you're interested. Okay. So we're going to play the same game here. We're going to talk about helicities. And it turns out that actually the numbers are the same. So we can have 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, 2, 5/2, and so on. The numbers are the same, but actually the implications are a little bit different. So if you go to your quantum mechanics textbook and you say, oh, I have a spin 1 particle, then m can be plus 1, 0, or minus 1. So there's 3 different states of spin 1. But with helicity, even though the number is 1, there's only left circular and right circular polarizations of a photon. And so these objects, for example, spin 2, this has 5 degrees of freedom. The m values are -1, -2, -1, 0, +1, +2. But with a massless one, helicity 2, there's only 2 degrees of freedom, +/-2 in terms of helicity. So the graviton, if you've heard any lectures on gravitational waves, and you'll see a lecturer do this like really funny, weird dance of the way that gravitons stretch and such, there's only 2 different ways that gravitons can stretch and distort space-time. Only 2 helicities. And this mismatch, by the way, between 5 and 2 is going to be a key punchline that's coming up in a moment. Okay. So I don't know whether you realize, like, in a moment I'm going to race the board and I'm going to tell you something that's, like, truly remarkable. Which you may or may not have heard. Some of you, I hope, have heard. A lot of you have not heard. We'll get to that in a moment. But just to warn you that you're on the brink of some knowledge that I wish I had been told at your age. when I found it out, I actually kind of, you know, mind-blown type of thing. But we're going to get there in a moment. Let me just tell you some of the consequences on this list. So, for example, with helicity greater than 1, or 1 and greater, this has a discontinuous massive limit. Or discontinuous massless limit. So if I take a spin 0 massive particle and I dial the mass down to 0, that's nice and continuous. Same thing with spin 1/2. But when I get to spin 1, there's a discontinuity. And so massive versus massless really means something different once you get to 1, especially for 2. That's a little bit of a hint of where we're going to go in a moment. For spin 5/2 and higher, these things can't have interactions. So there's no interactions here. So you can write down a theory of massless spin five halves particles, but it's really boring. Nothing happens. Okay. Again, I'm trying to pause a little bit for effect. I'm trying to see if anyone can kind of pick up on where I might be going. Some of you may have heard this before. Okay, so let me leave this here. I'm just going to erase this one panel. So apparently, if I want to specify the standard model, the ingredients of the standard model. So again, the massive cases here, we have four of these in the standard model. In terms of the massless degrees of freedom, so massless and standard model. What do we have? We have 45, weird number, spin one half fermions. And there's a qualifier that you may hear, it's called Weyl fermions. This is to distinguish them for Dirac fermions, which is often the starting point of quantum mechanics, or quantum field theory textbooks. Weyl fermions are actually the more fundamental thing. I'll describe a little bit later what the difference is. And 45, what a weird number. 45, of all the numbers to choose, nature decides that we need 45 of these spin half Weyl fermions. Why 45? Because 45 is 3 times 15. Which is even less enlightening. You're like, and then why 15? And like, so 15, the reason why it's 15 is because 15 is 6 plus 3 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1. You should ask more than that. Yeah, I'll explain a little bit, but this is like, did I do this right? So 6 plus 3 plus 3, that's 12, 13, 14, 15, 15. Like, and that's why. It's like, what the hell? That's strange, okay? And then there are 12 spin one bosons. You're like, 12, why 12? Oh, well, as everyone knows, 12 is equal to 1 plus 3 plus 8. And that's supposed to be, that's supposed to explain something, okay? Okay. And you're like, what the heck? This is bizarre. And so remarkably, this information that I just gave you, and I kind of really mean it, like when I wrote these numbers, this information, roughly speaking, with this information, you can reconstruct the entirety of the standard model, which maybe is strange, because I feel like I've just like given you numerology. That doesn't seem very fundamental. Okay, yeah, okay, you need to have 19 parameters. Actually, in my world, you need 20 parameters. As you'll see in a moment. That's what you need to describe the standard model. That's it. And again, it looks like numerology, but principles have consequences. You tell me the principles, quantum mechanics, locality, unitarity. You tell me the ingredients, and then there's actually not that much freedom, as we'll see in a moment. Okay, and now we're gonna see why so much of the standard model is inevitable. So let me pause here for a moment. Again, you're on the brink in like one board, something that I wish I had known when I was younger. And once I learned it, I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And now there's like a whole part of physics that I no longer have to worry about. It's very satisfying to me now that I know that principles have consequences. So let me pause here, see if there's any questions start erasing the board. But you know, now is an opportunity to ask things or again, ask what you might want to hear about in lecture two. To organize it. Have I built up enough suspense? Yes. I will explain the numbers. So I'll tell you where those numbers come from. But do you want to know the answer? Like, are you at the point where you're like, wait a second, like those numbers must have meaning. Can I say what they are right now? Eight is the dimensionality, the adjoint representation of SU3. Three is the dimensionality, the adjoint representation of SU2. Six is 2 times 3. which, right, so like this is, sorry, just to say this is 2 times 3. What? I'm not really helping. I mean, so what this is that, as we're going to see in a moment, quantum mechanics forces upon you that interactions of spin one particles take a particular form. Spin one particles, the historic way of talking about it is that they describe local gauge symmetries. And I don't actually like that way of talking about things. I rather say, let's just write down all things possibly consistent with quantum mechanics, of which you find that gauge theories emerge. And so those numbers are representations of gauge groups. So 3 is the fundamental representation of SU3 is dimension 3. 2, fundamental representation of SU2 is dimension 2. And then 2 times 3 is because we're going to have an SU2 times SU3 gauge symmetry. And that's something that's a bifundamental under that symmetry. That's where they're coming from. And then the fact that there's 3 of these has no deep meaning to the best of our knowledge, which is super frustrating. But that's the problem of flavor, which we can get into in a bit. Question over there. Can you toss it? You can toss it as long as you don't like aim for someone's head. I think it's okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a question of why specifically 3. So if you told me that the number was 7, I can come up with some explanation why it's 7. You tell me that the number is 2, I can come up with an explanation for why it's 2. So there may be a reason why it's 3, but it's not one that follows inevitably. It could be, I mean, why not 4? In fact, there's even reason to think that 4 might even be better. In fact, there is something special about 3, something really special about 3, in that it allows for a violation of a CP symmetry that's needed for baryogenesis, but it doesn't work. Like the 3 could have been special, it could have enabled baryogenesis, but the numbers don't work out. And so you have, it's like even more perplexing, like that something special about 3, and the thing that's special about 3 doesn't actually solve the problem for which that specialness could solve it. Three or more. So, were there other questions while I'm racing? Okay, so quantum mechanics constraints on massless particles. Okay, I'm going to write down a statement. Then I'm going to ask for a show of hands in a moment about how many people know the next words that I'm gonna write on the board, okay? So I'm gonna write down, we have a massless. So as I said, for massive particles above, for 5/2 and above in terms of helicity, there is no interacting theories. For massless spin 2 plus quantum mechanical principles, in particular unitarity, but also locality, causality, so on. This has an implication. If I just tell you the universe consists of, or has as one of its ingredients, a massless spin 2, really helicity 2, particle, and then I tell you it's a quantum mechanical universe. It's a quantum mechanical universe that has a consequence. So by show of hands, how many people know what I'm going to say next? Okay, I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so you are the enlightened ones. The rest of you have learned something in your youth that may even motivated you to become a physicist, and I am going to say something that will make you question your life decisions. Merely saying these words and working out all possible interactions of what a massless spin 2 particle could do. So, for example, a massless spin 2 particle can propagate. It could potentially interact with itself. Maybe it actually interacts with itself multiple times. Maybe it actually interacts with other stuff in the universe, and so on. Simply saying these words massless spin two particle plus unitarity, locality, causality. That implies the full nonlinear structure of Einstein's gravity. General relativity. You were probably told that there's an irreconcilable difference between quantum mechanics and general relativity. And there is one. So you weren't told a lie exactly, but you were told only part of the truth. So the truth is, in the weak field limit, where things can be well described by particles, and I don't need to talk about curvature of the universe, and I talk about the structure of interactions as if they were particle-like, then quantum mechanical unitarity tells you that you must have general relativity. There was no other option. There was no other way of talking about a massless spin two particle other than to have Einstein's gravity. And again, this is dictated by quantum mechanics. So these interactions are dictated by quantum mechanics. And if you say, how is that possible? You might have heard of something in quantum mechanics called the optical theorem. The optical theorem basically tells you conditions under which unitarity is preserved. And when you work out all the optical theorem-y rules about all these type of interactions, you find that the only thing left standing is Einstein's relativity. Quantum mechanics plus an assumption about the ingredients of the universe gives rise to general relativity. Very special form required of these interactions. This three-point interaction is proportional to the square root of the Newton's constant. There's only one free parameter, and that is G Newton. Everything else is fixed. And then, thank you. And then something that, you know, we think of as being really special, here, I'm just gonna write it down here just to keep it all on one board. Something that we think is really special is that if you have the spin two particle, it must couple to the conserved stress energy tensor. Again, this is quantum mechanics. And so, for example, this interaction here, which is of a graviton interacting with matter, that form is fixed by quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics. So why do people make a big deal about quantum gravity? Oh, like how do we get, you know, general relativity and quantum mechanics together? We need a theory of quantum gravity. I just told you that quantum mechanics gives you gravity. Why do we make a big deal about that mismatch? The reason why we make a big deal about that mismatch is because when you actually work out the consequences of this scattering with these interactions, you find that the theory breaks down and there's no way to reconcile it. So it predicts a breakdown, and the breakdown happens at the so-called Planck scale. And so indeed, there is no theory of quantum gravity that's valid to arbitrarily short distances. So there is a problem, but it's like the most beautiful problem ever, right? You say, I take quantum mechanics, I put in this ingredient, I get out gravity, success, and it tells me where to look for new physics. It tells me that if I could go to the Planck scale, that I'm guaranteed to find something different. Like that is like the definition in my mind of scientific success. Is to have something that predicts something and then also predicts the thing that you see next. Right? And that's the story of quantum gravity. And so, and for people who study quantum gravity, they know about this, obviously, but they really care about the strong field limit, the limit where you can't describe gravity well in terms of massless spin two particles. That's not a very effective description. But when people say that the standard model has 19 parameters, I like to say 20. Because you specify G Newton, this is the 20th standard model parameter. In my mind, kind of the standard model wants to talk to gravity. And this is the kind of 20th parameter that once you specify that, you get things like Newton's law. So it's just wild to think that Newton's law is a consequence of quantum mechanics. So, you know, we have the apple and, you know, we have the Earth. And apparently the Earth is a fermion and the apple's a fermion. the force, it has to be a 1/r potential. It has to be proportional to G Newton. It has to be proportional to the mass, has to couple those conserved stress energy. That's a consequence of quantum mechanics. It's no longer a mystery, it's just a consequence of having a massless spin two particle around. Okay, so by show of hands, how many people had their mind blown by this fact? Okay. Some of you had seen this before. Hopefully your mind has continued to be blown. But this is actually why I switched away from what? Is a question? Yeah, throw the cube. Yes. Yes, where's the equivalence principle? The equivalence principle is coming, well, okay, exactly where it comes from is a little bit complicated. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to have local interactions, but if I think about local interactions, you can kind of imagine like going to the rest frame of something and like seeing it. But I just told you I have a massless particle zooming around, and if I boost it, I can't get to the rest frame. I can't like see what its local small structure is. And in particular, if I could boost and get to the rest frame, then this thing, so this is not true. But here I have a graviton that has, this has 2 degrees of freedom. And this particle here, if it's spin two, then it would have 5 degrees of freedom, plus two, minus one, in terms of the m values. This would be 5 degrees of freedom. And if I'm not careful, and I don't make the interactions perfect, then when I'm trying to describe 2 degrees of freedom in a local way, I'll end up accidentally making 5 of them. So that mismatch between 2 and 5 forces you to couple things in a very special way. It forces you to have self-interactions of a very special form, and it says it's actually really hard to talk to anything else in the universe unless it's a conserved stress energy tensor. So, like, it's a little bit backwards. It's more like the equivalence principle is an outcome, like, and the whole geometric description of a gravity is an outcome of a different type of thing of saying, I want to make sure that quantum mechanics works, and in particular, this mismatch between 2 and 5 is really painful. And it's actually a miracle that you have any interactions whatsoever that allow you to make sure that you can't boost to the rest frame, because you really want it to be massless. And that mismatch is kind of at the heart of this. And that's why when you go to spin 5 halves and higher, it's actually you can't write down anything, because there's no freedom left. And here, again, but the only freedom that I have is G Newton, and I have to couple to the entire conserved stress energy tensor. I can't leave pieces of it out. But it's amazing, right? It's it's kind of long. Other questions? Yeah, can you pass the cube up there? Yeah. Oh, okay. Right? So I was told that if I wanted to get my trip to Stockholm or just get a faculty job, right? When I was an undergraduate, you know, it's like, oh, you want to solve the mystery of quantum gravity, which is up at the Planck scale. And the Planck scale is, sorry, can I do the math in my head? It's like, is it 15 orders of magnitude above the TeV scale, something like that? And did I get it right? And then you're like, but wait a second. We think we might discover new physics at the TeV scale because of a problem not with spin 2 particles, but with a problem with spin 1 particles. So why do I care about the Planck scale if I have this problem down here? And that's why I switched from being a string theorist in my first year of grad school to being a particle physicist, because I realized that the hierarchies of the scales were such that if I wanted to know where the most immediate discovery was going to be, it was going to be at the TeV scale, 15 orders of magnitude below the Planck scale. So that's how I had a career change from that. Now, other people say, wait a second, this is so profound. This is probably true in any universe. I don't really care about the details of the standard model and what's up with this number 45, and I don't find that beautiful at all, and I'd rather study more fundamental things that might be true, not just in our universe, but more general. And so the people who look at quantum gravity are not trying to necessarily understand our specific implementation of the standard model. They're attacking the more fundamental question about how can you have quantum mechanics for any quantum mechanical system and gravity for kind of any gravitational system talk to each other. So it's just a different intellectual question. But if you want to know, like, where's the next thing to go, you don't hunt for quantum gravity. You hunt for the thing below. At least that's my opinion. Now, course, there's subtle exceptions to that, which we can get into next time. But that's why I had a career change. Yeah? Good. Question here? I'm implicitly assuming Poincaré, and of course our universe is on long scales is closer to De Sitter, and so, you know, some people think that that might be a hint about what might be a deviation. But yeah, I'm assuming Poincaré. I'm assuming that for the symmetries that are relevant for our world. And then when I wanted to describe space-time curvature, curvature is like in quotes a coherent state of gravitons. But like the tapestry that our world lives in under this picture is a Poincaré universe. Yeah. Okay, so hearing this, then you start to get excited. You're like, oh my goodness, if I got this much out of massless spin two, I'm gonna get a lot more out of some of the other spins. And sadly, it doesn't work that way. So this is like incredible insight. And then you say, well, what if I want to have a massless spin 3/2 particle? And I want to have a valid description of interacting massless spin 3/2 particles. What does that lead to? It leads to an amazing prediction. It leads to the structure of so-called supergravity, which is the merger of gravity plus supersymmetry. And if people have heard about supergravity, and that people talk about n=1, n=2, n=8 supergravity. The n is the number of gravitons, roughly. Incredible. But it doesn't yet seem to describe nature. So it does not yet seem to describe nature. Some people hold out hope, including myself. But this is also interesting that the fermionic version of this story over here leads to the structure of supergravity. And that's, you know, one reason maybe to be optimistic that supersymmetry might be discovered, maybe not in my lifetime, but in someone's lifetime. Okay. Okay, so I'm gonna race the board. This basically, the reason why I agreed to give these lectures was to show this. I agreed to talk about the standard model because, you know, my own research program is actually in quantum chromodynamics. So I study jets of particles produced at high energy colliders. But I felt like if I'm gonna talk to tabletop folks who are thinking about fundamental things that you can do in the tabletop, this is probably the most important thing that I can tell you. Because if you're gonna mess with gravity, if you're gonna try to do tabletop experiments looking for fifth forces or whatnot, like this is what you're up against. This is not to say that there aren't things to discover, but like there's deep principles behind what we think we know already. Okay, so I'm going to, I'll leave this one up right now. So marching our way down, we can now talk about massless spin one particles plus unitarity, blah, blah, blah. And what comes out of that structure is what are known as gauge theories. But again, I want to emphasize that it's not, normally we say, oh, gauge theories are elegant, they describe local conserved objects. That's not the way that the logic is. It's like, if I want to do this, this is the only way that I know how to do it. If I want to have a massless spin one ingredients, that's the only way that I know how to do it. So for example, if you say I have just one massless spin one, what does that imply? That implies Maxwell's theories, electromagnetism. So in particular, with some caveats, you know, I have a photon. I have its interactions as dictated by Maxwell's equations. And no self-interactions are allowed. With an asterisk, okay, kind of. You can ask me about light by light scattering if you want. And what you learn, again, following this this argument, so we did the thing before. We said we had a spin one. You can't boost to the rest frame. With a spin one, if it's massless, then it has 2 degrees of freedom. If it's massive, it would have 3 degrees of freedom. And that mismatch between two and three means that if you want to have interactions, you have to have it of a very special form. And the photon must couple to conserved current. If it didn't, then you would find that there is a radiative instability and you would grow an extra degree of freedom, which you don't want. So in particular, if I have a photon and I want it to talk to some other matter particle, then this vertex is a charge and a coupling. So the charge, for example, for an electron, that's -1. And then the coupling is a free parameter. And it's, again, really amazing to think that from this quantum mechanics story, that Coulomb's law is a consequence of quantum mechanics. So Coulomb's law would say, like, if I had a proton and I want to have it interact with an electron, then the only thing it can be, it has to have, again, this 1 over r form for the potential. That's dictated by locality and the way that this propagator is structured. It has to be proportional to the charge of, let's say, the proton, the charge of the electron, and it has to be proportional to the coupling squared, or alpha, in this case, alpha EM, electromagnetic coupling. And again, that's a consequence of quantum mechanics. So, you know, the two things that you learned in, you know, the first things that you learned in your physics class about gravity and electromagnetism, those are consequences of quantum mechanics, their structure. So you might imagine that things get more interesting if I go beyond this assumption of just one massless spin one particle. So if I have more than one, massless spin one particle, then this allows for interactions. So I can have interactions that are go between, let's say, the A type, the B type, and the C type. And this interaction would be some coupling and then some so-called structure function, FABC. And those structure functions have a very special form. And those special form are dictated by group theory structures. And in particular, what you find out is that you have to have a Yang-Mills theory. And I'm not going to go into detail about this, given the time. But in the context of the standard model, there are three gauge groups in the standard model, basically three sets of massless spin one particles that, in certain cases, can have interactions. So we have SU2, U1, and SU3. And these two, SU2 and U1, kind of come together in terms of what's sometimes called SU2 left and U1 hypercharge. I'll explain a little more about that later. And what Yang-Mills theory tells you is that you look at the group theory, you look up the adjoint representation, you look up the dimensionality of the adjoint representation, and those are the allowed interactions of a set of massless spin one particles. So the adjoint representation of SU2 has dimension 3. The adjoint representation of U1, well, that's the same thing as electromagnetism, so that's just 1. And this gives you so-called electroweak theory. And then SU3, this is often called SU3 color. And there are 8 of these. And this describes quantum chromodynamics. And there's these 3-point interactions. There's also 4-point interactions. And the structure of these 4-point interactions, which have to be proportional to G squared and have some other structure, let's say A, B, C, D, H, A, B, C, D, these interactions here and these interactions here have to be of a very special form, which happens to correspond to a gauge symmetry. So oftentimes we say, oh, gauge theories are really beautiful. We love gauge theories. And then you get this fascinating mathematical structure of group theory. Here we can actually do it the other way around and say, break down everything. And then you find that after the dust has settled, the only things that are consistent are things of a gauge symmetry form. And that funny 12 that I gave you before is 1 plus 3 plus 8 is because this happens to be the structure within the standard model that we see. Question here. I'm going to toss the cube. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, so your complaint is, your question is, isn't this only a statement about weak field? Okay, so the question was, all this stuff that I'm telling you about inevitability and quantum mechanics, all this assumes that I have a particle-like description, that I'm a weakly coupled theory. And, well, what if I'm not in the weakly coupled theory? And the answer is, if you're not in the weakly coupled theory, then you can't even start with particles. Particles aren't the right description, and then I can't run any of this logic. Like, I don't even know what to talk about. So the states themselves have kind of some kind of spin structure overall, but I can't talk about isolated particles once I'm in the strongly coupled regime. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, good. So to the best of my knowledge, it is. To the best of my knowledge, it is. So it gets complicated when you start like asking what is the meaning of a theory. So all my arguments are done with Poincaré. And then you say, well, what happens if I were to compactify electromagnetism on some non-trivial manifold? And like, does that have, do I view that as being additional implications or constraints on quantum field theories? So, in the context of Poincaré, you would say, this is what the structure has to be perturbatively. And then if you want everything to be satisfying, you know, the path integral, and say it's part of the path integral, and that's your definition of the theory is via the path integral, then yeah, you get all those non-perturbative phenomena for free. So it's a bit like saying, if I have a weakly coupled description, am I sure that if I go up, that there's a unique strongly coupled version of that? That's kind of what you're asking. Tell me what quantum mechanics is without the path integral. So that the assumption is that quantum mechanics is correct, and then once you say that quantum mechanics is correct, I think you say, oh, then I have the path integral, and then I build up this whole structure. I don't think that, I mean, there may be some other way out. There may be like, but I think you violate quantum mechanics if you start doing that. So it's a little bit like saying, or it's like saying I have this weakly coupled structure that tells me the interactions, and then I embed that into quantum mechanics, and then I just look at the consequences. Maybe there's some other way of embedding that have different consequences. I'm not aware of one, but it's also in the strong field regime where I get very uncomfortable myself. Okay, so I have 9 minutes. By the way, this is my research area is in QCD, and in particular applying artificial intelligence techniques to understand QCD. So somehow in 9 minutes, I'm supposed to tell you the rest of the standard model, at least its ingredients, and then we can have a coffee break. And then you can tell me what you want to learn about on Wednesday. And the answer is now looking at my notes, I can't quite get there, so there's going to be some things that are left over. But let me try my best to kind of round out this story. So going down our chain of spin, we would have massless spin a half fermions. And they have no constraints, apart from the one I already said. So you need to just specify, you know, what is their charges under, in the case of the standard model, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, and you're good to go. That's all you need to do. These are discrete choices that you have to make. A subtlety here is that the natural way of talking about massless spin a half fermions are so-called Weyl fermions. And Weyl fermions are weird. So when you have spin, you have both left and right helicity. And so we have Weyl fermions are a weirdo combination of left-handed particles and right-handed antiparticles. And so, like, within a Weyl fermion, you would have, let's say, the left-handed electron and the right-handed positron. And you're like, wait a second, there's right-handed electrons too. And if you want that, you need to make another Weyl fermion. So if you want if you want the reverse, so if you want reverse, need another Weyl. What about massless spin zero bosons? Well, to the best of our knowledge, with some exceptions, this is radiatively unstable. With a question mark. There's some exceptions, particles that are known as Goldstone bosons, but those aren't typically associated with being fundamental. And what this means is that if you're trying to get something to be close to massless, which we need for the Higgs boson, sorry, you can't do it. Radiatively unstable, it wants to get a really big mass. And that's this question of naturalness that shows up. So unfortunately, for these spin a half and spin zero, there aren't the same level of constraints. And in particular, all the ugliness of the standard model are associated with these annoying, well, the massive ones, these annoying ingredients. So with this, we can build the standard model on one page. And now I'm trying to contemplate what I should do now. So show of hands, I can do one of two things, and I'll save the other one for next time. Would you rather that I build the standard model, or would I rather that I build QED? So QED is kind of like a warm-up problem, and so you might want to know what does quantum electrodynamics look like. Or I can do the full standard model and save QED for next time. So by show of hands, let's do QED first. Who wants to see QED done out? Okay, I see that, and then standard model out. Okay, it's like almost equals 50-50. Okay, so then I will follow pedagogically the starting from small and building up. So we'll build the standard model next time. So the standard model is the beginning of next time. So apologies to those folks who wanted to see it all and see those that stupid 3 times 15 structure. Let's just do this in QED and wrap up today. And by the way, thank you for your questions. It's much more fun for me when you ask questions. Keep asking questions. Keep pushing me at the coffee breaks and otherwise. This is why we're all here in person, which is incredible to see you in person, despite the fact that I'm sweating. It's like really embarrassing. Okay, so building quantum electrodynamics, which I'm supposed to be able to do in like 3 minutes. What is QED? Well, in my world, it's going to be QED plus general relativity. So we say we have a massless spin to graviton with one free parameter, g nu. We have a massless spin one photon with one free parameter, the 1 over 137 alpha electromagnetic. We have two spin a half Weyl fermions. And they have names E and EC. So C is doesn't mean, C means it has the conjugate charges of E. So E, maybe not surprisingly, is for electron. So we need to specify, as I said before, the U1 electromagnetic charge. E has charge minus one. EC has charge plus one. And these things, which start their life off as massless vial fermions, because I have conjugate charges here, they can marry up together and become a massive Dirac fermion. And so, as I said, there's a continuous limit between massive and massless for fermions. For spin a half fermions, and this is that. So you start off saying, oh, maybe the universe is massless vial fermions. Oh no, we have conjugate charges, therefore they can marry up. And yeah, that's QED. That plus the quantum constraints, that gives you all of QED. And so, like, what does that automatically have for you? Again, consequences of quantum mechanics, Poincaré. CPT, spin statistics, all that fun principles. It says that I have an electron and it has an antiparticle, a positron. And then in terms of interactions, the photon can interact with this object. And this vertex gives a variety of things. This vertex gives electric charge. So when I want to talk about the Coulomb interaction, this photon-electron interaction gives electric charge. But at the same time, for free, because of the structure of Lorentz invariants and such, it also gives the magnetic coupling. The fact that in the magnetic field, there's a magnetic moment for an electron. And so the fact that we have this, so what does G call? Is it the gyromagnetic ratio, yeah, gyromagnetic coupling, that G is 2, comes from this vertex. It's QED, things are quantum mechanical. And so we have vertex corrections. And this gives you two things that come kind of together, again, because of Lorentz symmetry, quantum mechanics altogether. This gives the fact that couplings run. So depending on scale, you actually get different values of the electromagnetic coupling, so it gives a running coupling. But at the same time, it also gives you the anomalous gyromagnetic ratio. So the anomalous G minus 2 of the electron comes from that interaction. And then with these ingredients, you write down all interactions consistent with that. These ingredients conserve charge conjugation, parity, time reversal. And so what that means is that there's no electric dipole moment for the electron. And I'm happy to talk more about that if you want next time. But in, okay, a little over my 5 minutes that I promised, we were able to build up the structure of a theory describing nature where I was able to do it with very few equations, a lot of hand waving, a lot of claiming things and not proving it. But this is one way, or at least this is the way that I think about QED, as kind of inevitable consequences of specifying the particle content and seeing its quantum implications. So we will continue with this on Wednesday. Thanks so much, and let's wrap it up here. Thanks. Yes. Yeah. Good. So once you start saying that space-time is discrete and no longer continuous, all bets are off. All this required that at arbitrary short distances, that this is the description of nature. And an example of this is people say, well, let's do a naive discretization and let's do what's called lattice gauge theory. And let's put the standard model on a lattice and actually make things discrete. And once you do that, it turns out that certain features of the standard model are very difficult to realize. And actually, there's a discontinuity between the continuum and discrete, which people who work in lattice gauge theory suffer with. If you've ever heard of a problem called the fermion doubling problem, that's a problem that arises when you say, oh, actually, the structure of fermions is different on a discrete lattice versus in the continuum. So if you tell me that space-time is discrete, all bets are off. Now, if you start saying, well, let's measure the spin of fundamental particles, I don't even know what that means. Like, I don't know what it means to allow... Okay, that's not entirely true. There are some people who have done some very cool things of what happens if you have non-integer or non-half-integer values, these so-called continuous spin representations. They make my brain explode. But actually trying to constrain, like, the photon, is it really spin one or helicity one, or does it have some deviation? That's a fascinating thing. It is subtle about whether they could or could not have interactions. What? Is this Kevin?
Yeah.
Hey, good to see you. Other questions? Was there anything else online? Yeah, I'm going to toss the... So it's actually, I just gave Feynman's argument. So this is Feynman's argument. Oh, sorry. So the question was, if you look at the history of physics and like asking about inverse square law for electromagnetism and looking at gravity, inverse square law for gravity, sorry, for Newton's law and then for electrodynamics. And then, you know, talking about equivalence principle and gravity. And then QED was the way of manifesting that. Electrodynamics, but then there was a failure with gravity. There isn't a failure with gravity. It was Feynman who showed the argument that I just gave, that if you insist on gravity being described by a spin two particle, then you get general relativity coming out. In terms of contradictions, there are no contradictions until you get to the Planck scale. So if you take the point of view of an effective field theorist, which I am, and that theories have ranges of validity, and as long as they don't make as long as they're consistent with their range of validity, it's okay, then there is no contradiction. Where you start to get into trouble is if you're like, you know, near the event horizon of a black hole, or if you're trying to think about cosmological issues, or you want to talk about, you know, other types of more curved stuff. But if it's in the weak field limit, you just mechanically go through the motions of saying, I want to build a quantum mechanical consistent thing. Don't ever say anything about geometry. Don't ever say anything about diffeomorphism invariants. And what you'll find is that the only things that you can write down happen to be consistent with diffeomorphisms. And it's a very different way of thinking about things. And I think, you know, the history of science is one where, as we learn more, there's often alternate ways of describing things that were discussed in a previous language. And oftentimes it becomes easier to understand. So for example, we often talk about, or at least when I learned quantum mechanics, it was like, okay, you take the classical theory and then you quantize it. And that works if you have a classical theory, if you have a quantum theory that has a classical limit. But fermions don't have a classical limit. So if you want to understand fermions, it's not like there's a classical fermion theory that then you then quantize. It's just that quantum mechanics is true. And I think it's helpful to have this kind of ahistoric perspective on saying, okay, what do we think we know now? Can I rebuild the assumptions that I had based on the knowledge that I do now. So it's just a it's a different perspective. But and hopefully you end up in the same point. And so it could have been that we discovered that actually there's more than one version of a massless spin too. That could have been also transformative. We didn't. We discovered that it's a uniquely specified theory. It could have been that there were deviations from massless spin one, that maybe there's something beyond gauge theories. Nope, that appears to be all that there is. And now it's easier to understand why was it that you had to have compact gauge symmetries and not non-compact. Like certain things just become a lot easier from the more modern perspective. But yeah, it's amazing that science is able to persist where different modes of reasoning get you to the same conclusion, and that we gain even deeper insights in my mind about old ideas by seeing it through the new lens. This question here.
The way you say, oh, you don't have a side by side, the power between two interactions, it's because it's non renormalizable, and that's why it's small. But once you go to the quantum gravity, you no longer can argue that you're doing it for the network of your network.
Yep.
So we're doing it by the gravity part of the power.
Oh, good. So good. So the asterisk that I was saying is that actually, if you say what's a consistent theory of gravity, it's not. I mean, I said there's only one free parameter, G Newton, but actually, no. It's also the coefficient of the R squared, R to the 26. All those are all consistent. So it's actually not true that there's only one consistent theory. Same thing with gauge theories. You can write down higher order interactions, and like it's just interesting to see those subtleties in a new light. That. The ambiguities are ones for which we had a different language for before. So the ambiguities are all in the non-renormalizable structure. But then from this logic, you see, oh, no, I'm allowed to have those ambiguities, and they're irrelevant for describing most of the physics that we see. But it's this reason that I get into arguments with my friends about whether the standard model has neutrino masses or not. Because from my perspective, you write down the ingredients, you write down all interactions, and as I'll describe next time, you write down those interactions and neutrinos have mass. And people say, no, the standard model doesn't have neutrino masses. And it's like, well, based on the logic that I'm going to show you, you write down everything consistent with the symmetries, and there you go, you're going to see a neutrino mass showing up on Wednesday. But there's a question, this is kind of this historical thing about historically when the standard model was established, it was without irrelevant operators. Neutrino masses come from an irrelevant operator, so that's why people exclude it. My mind, you should. My mind, you should put it there. In fact, and thereby go measure it. So I think you're right. It changes our view about irrelevant operators. It says actually they should still be included in the theory, at least the way that I think about the theory. Question here. So just to repeat the question, was, you know, there are certain cases where you're in very long wavelength, nowhere near the Planck scale, and yet there's deviations, or there's interesting gravity features that you need to, they're features that are problematic quantum mechanically. So how do I get out of that? I get out of that because I assumed Poincaré. If on long wavelengths you have something like a horizon, nope, no more Poincaré, and so I absolve myself. I don't need to make predictions for you because my assumption about asymptotic Poincaré-ness is gone. So that's how I weasel my way out of this. It's not very satisfying, but it makes me sleep well at night that I can I don't feel like I need to explain through this type of logic that type of quantum gravity issue that's on long wavelengths because there was an assumption baked in the Poincaré-ness. It is hard to avoid thinking about these other features, but there's no solution to them within this context. you know, in the case of having Event Horizon, like, it's not just, it's, sorry, I said asymptotically Poincaré, it's really like everywhere Poincaré, because it's not just at infinity for scattering, like you're really assuming that there's local interactions even within the bulk of space-time. So if you have a horizon that excises some region, you're like, it's no longer satisfying the rules that I set out for myself. But that's another way of understanding why the story I gave is a little bit too flip, that there's a lot of assumptions baked in that are violated by interesting gravitational systems. And that's why it's still an active and exciting area of research to even study the long wavelength consequences of gravity. Yes. There is something missing in this picture. Absolutely. This isn't to say that there is, but it says in the, again, I it says for weak field things, of which if you're creating a black hole, that's not a weak field thing. For weak field things, I feel comfortable. So for example, I can show you the quantum mechanical correction to Newton's law. And the fact that you can write that down is for me amazing as someone who thinks about short distance physics, but for someone who thinks about long distance physics, they say, well, there's global structure that's not captured by this. And I think, and that's just absolutely true. Yeah. That's a question. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so you mean for describing gravity? Yeah. Yeah. Good. So we can go for the object. So if your goal is to say, I see this gravitational long range interaction, I want to have it be a force mediated by a particle, and I want it to always be attractive, then I think that gets you. I think that gets you to even integers. So 0, 4, 0, 2, 4, 6, so on. 0 has the wrong structure. It's also radiatively unstable, so we can get rid of that. 4, you can't write down a theory of self-interaction, nor for 6, and so on. So you're left with 2. And it could have been that nothing worked. And instead, the only thing that works is GR. So 2 is uniquely, by Feynman's argument, is uniquely specified if you want an attractive long-range force. And yeah, it's no longer a mystery why it's that. And so it couldn't have been 4 for the reasons that you can't write down a quantum mechanically consistent theory of massless spin 4 self-interaction. Right, thank you. Thank you.